It's Monday, November 11, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Sometimes predictions of an imminent weather disaster turn out to be unfounded, and those unfounded predictions often lead to a more casual response on the part of the public when they hear the kind of warning repeated once again. But when it comes to Typhoon Haiyan that hit the Philippines over the weekend, the warnings turned out to be anything but unfounded. Meteorologists had initially indicated that the storm was likely to be massive and that massive loss of life was a very real possibility. But as the storm actually hit as the weekend began, the initial reports came in suggesting that the storm might be less dangerous than had been predicted. Tragically, those early assurances were unwarranted. As the Associated Press reported on Sunday, the death toll from one of the strongest storms on record that ravaged the central Philippine city of Tacloban could reach 10,000 people. That's just in one city, in one area of the Philippines. As the Associated Press went on to report, the typhoon barreled through six central Philippine islands on Friday, wiping away buildings and leveling seaside homes with a ferocious wind of 147 miles per hour, with gusts up to 170 miles per hour. By those measurements, Haiyan would be comparable to a strong Category 4 hurricane in the United States and nearly in the top category of 5. Since the time of that report, however, it has been indicated that the storm probably actually was a Category 5 storm. Some weather experts placed Haiyan's maximum winds not at 147 miles per hour with gusts up to 170, but at 195 miles per hour with gusts topping 235 miles per hour. Those are effectively tornado force and speed winds within a storm the giant size of a hurricane. Sometimes reports in the aftermath of a storm like this are actually very hard to verify, but I give credence to the report in the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, that the storm was actually far more powerful than had even earlier been predicted. Stephen Golby, a disaster management expert at Nottingham Trent University, told the BBC that the typhoon was, quote, probably the most intense and strongest storm of this type to make landfall, end quote. What becomes clear in his statement is that he means this is the strongest storm ever to hit land, that is. He went on to explain, quote, we've seen storms like this, perhaps on rare occasions, that have had that kind of intensity out at sea. But for it to come ashore with that kind of strength is almost unprecedented, end quote. The Associated Press reported that at least 750,000 people, that's a quarter of a million people, have been forced to flee their homes in anticipation of the storm or in its immediate aftermath. The BBC also reported that the situation on the ground in the Philippines was, quote, absolute bedlam, end quote. In that one city, Tacloban, at least 10,000 people are feared to be dead. Again, that's just one city. 4 million people in the Philippines are now affected directly by the storm. International aid efforts led by the International Red Cross and also with assistance from American government sources has begun, but as one government spokesman on the ground said, when asked the question, what is needed, the answer was simple, everything. As Christians in the United States pray for the people of the Philippines, as we pray particularly for those who are grieving and for those who even now are in distress or danger, we need to recognize that there may be other things we can do as well. Prayer is the first response, always the right response. We need to pray for those aid and distress workers on the ground, all those who are involved in the relief after this storm, and we need also to pray for those Christian pastors and missionaries in the nation of the Philippines who even now are trying to put together the communities they serve and the people they love. Shifting the scene to Europe, this past Saturday marked the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, that night the Germans now call Reichsprogramnacht, but which the rest of the world knew as the Night of Broken Glass, Kristallnacht. That was the night when action against the Jews led to the death of 91 Jews and another 30,000 taken prisoner. It led to the deportation to the concentration camps and laid the foundation for the Holocaust, the genocide of the Nazis against the Jewish people, leading to an eventual 6 to 7 million deaths, deaths by extermination, starvation, and other forms of murder under the aegis of the Third Reich. One of the best reports on this 75th anniversary comes from McClatchy News Service and their Foreign Bureau. As they write, Saturday did mark the 75th anniversary of that night, the Night of Broken Glass. By the time it was over, Nazi thugs had killed 91 Jews, taken 30,000 others prisoner for deportation to concentration camps. Thousands of businesses and synagogues were burned or destroyed. The report then summarizes the night as a night of animalistic violence in Germany, Austria, and the occupied region of Czechoslovakia. It did happen and began on November the 9th, 1938. It bled over into the early hours of November the 10th and then burst into the next 6.5 years. As the report rightly documents, Nazi stormtroopers kicked it off, smashing windows painted with Jew in white letters, bannering some Jews. Others joined in, looting, taunting, and spitting on the Jewish victims. From a Christian worldview perspective, one of the most insightful comments on this tragic anniversary came from Deidre Berger, the director of the American Jewish Committee in Berlin. She said, quote, "It's important to understand why the veneer of civilization was so easily cracked," end quote. From a biblical and theological perspective, that is the hardest question. We are accustomed, sadly so, to the reality that some human beings are capable of atrocious crimes. The biggest and most difficult moral question when it comes to the persecution and genocide of the Jews in Germany is not why did the direct perpetrators do what they did. We have sadly seen that kind of violence and murderous intent before. But why did the normal German citizen in these communities let it happen? That is the harder question, the more difficult question, indeed, almost the insoluble question. That's exactly what Deidre Berger was referring to when she spoke of that veneer of civilization that was so easily cracked. She went on to explain, quote, "It takes so little to tip the scales. It really shows the fragility of political systems. In one night, so many people who had grown up together turned and attacked the dignity and the safety of their neighbors, laughed as they were arrested," end quote. That's the really haunting element of this sad 75th anniversary of the Night of Broken Glass. It would be easier for us to understand in moral terms why certain people did what they did, the perpetrators. But when it comes to those who were, to use another word for it, the facilitators, it's really hard to imagine how an entire civilization can escape the judgment of history. That is probably the most important reason why we need to observe this kind of anniversary, tragic though it is. We need to remember it, lest it happen again. Once again, back in the United States, the federal courts were making news over the weekend. The first courtroom was in New Jersey, where a federal judge upheld the New Jersey law barring therapists from trying to turn gay youth straight. That's the way the Associated Press covered the story. You'll recall that New Jersey, following the state of California, has passed legislation that criminalizes psychological and therapeutic approaches to try to help young people become straight, that is, to leave behind a homosexual sexual orientation or temptation and instead move into a heterosexual pattern. There have been challenges to the laws both in California and New Jersey. A good deal of the law in California is currently on hold because a federal court has taken seriously the charge that the law is an unconstitutional violation of free speech, telling therapists and mental health professionals what they can and, more importantly, cannot say in the course of doing their professional business. In the New Jersey case, the judge threw out that argument. The judge was Frieda L. Wolf. In her ruling, she said that the New Jersey law does not violate free speech or religious protection. The law, she said, quote, "on its face does not target speech, and counseling is not entitled to special constitutional protection merely because it is carried out through talk therapy," end quote. The judge appears to be on very shaky legal ground here because other judicial decisions and precedents have stated very clearly that the kind of conversation that takes place in the therapeutic context or a professional context in which you have a counselor speaking to a counselee is indeed covered by free speech and by the associated confidentiality understandings. The plaintiffs in the New Jersey case, those challenging the law, also claim that the New Jersey statute violates parental rights, which it obviously does. It'll be very interesting to see just how long it takes this issue to get before the United States Supreme Court. When it comes to the second issue, the likelihood is that we will hear before Thanksgiving that the Supreme Court has decided to take up legal challenges to the constitutionality of the so-called contraception mandate that is a part of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. You'll recall that the Obama administration is requiring all employers with a very narrow set of religious exemptions to offer a free range of contraceptions under the insurance coverage offered to their employees. Furthermore, that coverage must include at least some contraceptives that are identified as at least potential abortifacients, at least potentially sometimes causing an abortion. The federal court decision in this case came as a surprise. As the Wall Street Journal reports, a federal appeals court on Friday blocked a provision of the Obama administration's health care law requiring employers to provide birth control coverage and employee insurance, ruling that it imposed a substantial burden on religious rights of two Midwestern companies. Here's what's really surprising. The move by the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago marked the first time a federal appeals court has issued a ruling preventing the federal government from enforcing the provision. That's right. This court actually effectively set down an injunction telling the Obama administration that, at least for now, it cannot proceed with the enforcement of this policy. That is a very big development. The Chicago Federal Appeals Court cited the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, a federal statute, in arguing that the Obamacare legislation mandate had effectively put a burden on the religious liberty rights of those who were the plaintiffs in this case. Writing for a 2-1 majority, Judge Diane S. Sykes made a very interesting comparison. She said that if corporations have no religious rights, then there can be no such thing as a kosher deli. A very interesting point. She points out that a kosher deli is allowed to operate on the basis of its own religious identity, even if that means prejudice and discrimination in terms of other products. As Judge Sykes explains, if there are no religious rights for a corporation like a restaurant or a deli, it can be denied the ability to observe kosher dietary restrictions. In a very interesting and revealing response, Judge Ilana Rovner, writing in dissent, said that her colleagues had ascribed a right to corporations that was uniquely human. A very interesting statement she made, quote, "Religious beliefs have to do with such fundamental questions as the nature of mankind, where we came from, our place in the world, what happens when we die, and our relationships with and obligations to other people." She continued, quote, "A corporation is a legal construct, which does not have the sentience and conscience to entertain such ultimate questions," end quote. The interesting paradox of Judge Rovner's position is that corporations are found either innocent or guilty of things that require sentience and conscience all the time. By putting the mandate of the Obama administration effectively on hold, this court basically sets up once again, as we saw even at the end of last week, an opportunity for the Supreme Court to take the case. In fact, it has presented a situation with conflicting decisions at the highest appellate level of the federal courts, such that the Supreme Court will be hard-pressed not to take the case. An announcement is expected before Thanksgiving. On another front, the Obama administration made a major announcement related to the Affordable Care Act on Friday, announcing that insurance companies in the qualified programs would have to offer mental health coverage on par with other forms of medical help, including surgery and other forms of medical treatment. This is a major decision. It was applauded by those in the mental health community and by many others, especially those in the national press. An example of this is the editorial board of the New York Times that exclaimed in Saturday's edition of the paper, quote, "A decades-long struggle to force insurers to cover mental health and addiction services on the same basis as medical and surgical costs is headed for success under new rules issued on Friday by the Obama administration." There are a couple of very interesting aspects to this. First of all, the language used by the editors suggesting that the equivalence comes down to these issues, mental health on the one hand, medicine on the other hand, being treated on the same basis. In the news story that was published in the Friday edition of the New York Times, the paper explained it this way, using the term "just like," as in, quote, "The Obama administration Friday completed a generation-long effort to require insurers to cover care for mental health and addiction just like physical illnesses, this coming in long-awaited regulations defining parity in benefits and treatment," end quote. So the editorial used the language "the same basis as," the news coverage in the same paper said "just like." Meanwhile, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, citing former First Lady Rosalynn Carter's efforts for a decade to convince the world that mental illness should be treated like other medical concerns, said that her effort had been to convince the world that mental illness is no different from physical illness, end quote. There is most likely a general consensus in America that some level of mental health treatment needs to be included in health insurance. Indeed, the United States Congress adopted a law in 2008 mandating this very thing, but only if insurance coverage was actually offered. Now that it's mandated, the Obama administration's policies are catching up with the new law. My concern in raising this issue is the very clear effort to try to suggest that mental health treatment is the same as, on the same basis as, just like, other forms of medical treatment. In reality, it of course is not. It may be covered the same way, but we need to recognize that we're not talking about two exactly the same forms of treatment. After all, if you're looking at modern medicine, you're talking about generally a very unified approach to treatment and the understanding of disease. When you come to the mental health industry and the therapeutic world, you're talking about rival worlds of understanding about the most basic issues at stake. The announcement made by the Obama administration is perfectly consistent with the general rise of the therapeutic worldview in our day. This was made clear in an editorial that appeared in Saturday's edition of the New York Times, in which the editors absolutely gushed over the Obama administration's announcement. The editors then included this astounding statement, quote, "About a quarter of Americans 18 and older have a diagnosable mental disorder in a given year, and 6% have a seriously debilitating disorder, according to the National Institute of Mental Health." Now, wait just a minute. About a quarter of Americans 18 and older have a diagnosable mental disorder in any given year? One quarter of all adult Americans in a single year? That doesn't make sense. But it is documented by the editors, and it is issued as one of the reasons why this policy announcement was so important and is to be so welcomed. All this is going to lead, inevitably, to a massive expansion, along with all the related costs, of the mental health industry. The editors of the New York Times seem to recognize this as well when they write, quote, "And more money may be needed to invest in behavioral health clinics or other providers to meet the demand for services by people who suddenly have insurance to pay the bill. Merely having an insurance policy is no guarantee that a provider can be found to deliver the necessary care." In other words, what Philip Reif years ago called the triumph of the therapeutic is triumphing to an even greater and unprecedented degree in our own times. Finally, today, November the 11th, marks Veterans Day in the United States, a very important day for our national observation in which we honor those who wore the nation's uniform and, in particular, saw battle in the American cause. The first American veterans to be so recognized were the veterans of World War I. But that war, that marks its 100th anniversary of its start next year, now has no surviving veterans whatsoever. And there are now fewer and fewer veterans of World War II. As the Associated Press reports, when that war was over, there were 16 million veterans. That's right, 16 million veterans. As the Associated Press report explains, they were young soldiers, sailors, and Marines who returned to work, raised families, and built lives. Over the decades, children grew up, married, had children of their own, careers were built and faded into retirement. Romance followed the pattern from the altar to the homestead and often, sadly, to the graveyard. One of the most amazing reports on this year's observance of Veterans Day comes from Dan Sewell of the Associated Press. He reports, "The last of the Doolittle Raiders, all in their 90s, offered a final toast this past Saturday to their fallen comrades as they pondered their place in history after a day of fanfare about their 1942 attack on Japan. It was an amazing act of bravado on the part of the American Armed Forces. The Empire of Japan had declared war on the United States, but before declaring war, it launched a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. The United States had to do something to project American pride and military force in the Pacific theater, but it was hard-pressed to do so. In an audacious and breathtaking plan, General Jimmy Doolittle decided to try to launch a bombing of the Japanese homeland from carrier-launched bombers. The bombers could be launched from carriers, but they could not land on them. The bombers went to Japan, indeed surprised the Japanese, bombed the homeland, embarrassed the emperor, and then flew on, most of them crash-landed, in either Burma or China. There were originally 80 Doolittle Raiders, 73 survived the bombing, and now only 4 veterans survive. A fifth died just a few months ago. It had been planned that there would be a final meeting when they were down to 2. But out of the immediate fear that they would be unable ever to meet again and that death might take them all at once, they decided to meet this past Saturday for one last time, and they did so, honoring their fallen comrades. As Dan Sewell reports, The Raiders said at the time they didn't realize their mission would be considered an important event in turning the war's tide. It inflicted only modest damage physically, but changed Japanese strategy while firing up Americans. The event for the Doolittle Raider survivors was an invitation-only event, and the most important quote actually goes to a 12-year-old boy who was brought to the occasion. His name is John Joseph Caliano. His grandparents brought him to the event from their home in Dayton, Ohio. He said, and I quote, "This was Tokyo. The odds of their survival were one in a million. I just felt like I owe them a few short hours of the thousands of hours I'll be on Earth." End quote. May that 12-year-old boy's words be an example to each of us as we consider our responsibility to honor and give thanks to those who paid so much in order that we may enjoy the liberties we know today. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Tulsa, Oklahoma, where today I'll be addressing the pastors' conference of the Oklahoma Baptist Convention. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.